again to another episode of Sacktown Talks. Today, we're glad to be rejoined again by Christina Garcia. Christina, thanks for coming in. How's it going?
Yeah, it's good. You know, no complaints, working hard.
It's funny. It's like 10 years ago, I remember meeting you when you were just a candidate coming in. And now here you are 10 years later, a candidate once more for a different office, taking on, you know, a congressional race. Can you tell us a little bit about your race and kind of your decision to kind of try to jump to Congress?
Yeah, not at all my intention. If you would have talked to me mid-December, I was planning to term out in 24 and go back to the classroom, and that made me happy. But when Congresswoman Roybal announced her retirement, that same sense of responsibility I had 10 years ago to fight for Southeast LA and make sure we had a strong voice kicked in. We're one of the most marginalized communities. During the pandemic, we were the epicenter of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths, and we also saw the least resources oftentimes. And so, you know, there's too much at stake. And as money is flowing from Congress to do infrastructure, I want to make sure it's coming, but it's lifting up everyone and not just parts of the communities out there. And so jumped in. And, you know, just like my first race, we're always underestimated. But the community has always bet on me. I'm going to bet on them.
Yeah, I remember 10 years ago, it was a big surprise that you won and that you kind of went, you know, there was, you know, notable challengers and you came out on top. And I remember up here in Sacramento, everyone was like, whoa, who is this girl? Like, where'd she come from? Kind of facing that again, kind of, why do you like being that underdog? And like, how do you prevail, like, each time? You've done this numerous times.
I don't think anyone likes to be an underdog. Mm-hmm. I think people need to ask themselves why they keep making me an underdog when I've been tried and tested so often and we always come out on top. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because I lead with the community first. I'm a strong advocate of not just for them, but with them. And if you talk to my community residents, they talk about how they've lacked representation for decades, for all my life or longer. And so I think they're excited that I'm of the community and I'm always with them and fighting for them. And, you know, I have many years, but at least 10 years in the legislature of not just fighting, but bringing stuff to the district and moving issues that people don't want to talk about and making them a common conversation. So that's period equity. Right now, we all talk about it, but no one was talking about it when I started on that. Environmental justice, or, you know, this year talking about freeways and how they displace communities like mine out there. And so they're issues that don't have a natural lobby, issues that affect our most marginalized community members. And someone has to speak up. And so I think at the end of the day, that resonates with my community and the voters.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. So like redistricting happened and kind of, you know, we had this thing where 12 years, you know, was it 10 years ago, we had this big group influx of members, this class, you were part of it. And everyone thought, you know, oh, these members can stay for 12 years. They're definitely staying for 12 years. But we all kind of forgot that every 10 years kind of districts are redone, redistricted. And I guess we didn't anticipate that maybe the districts would be changing as much as they did this year. I guess did redistricting kind of like take you by surprise, and did redistricting have any, I guess, aid or decision for you to kind of jump in this congressional race?
No, I mean, during redistricting, I always said no matter where I land or who I land with, I'm going to run and I'm going to win. So I wasn't worried about that. But I think, you know, I think none of us kind of thought about the domino effect of how redistricting does affect folks above us and below us and how that creates a domino effect. And I'm the chair of the Women's Caucus, and we've been preparing to, you know, for 2022, and I thought maybe I was going to have a dozen races to work with, and I have 35 suddenly. The Women's Caucus is going to grow. We're ready. I've been, for the 10 years I've been here, we've been working on this, and so we're ready for this moment. It's coming a little bit sooner than we anticipated. And it caught all of us, I think, most of us actually, by surprise. Right. Probably some folks were wiser out there, but I would say the majority was just kind of like, oh, wait. Afterwards, after, you know, hindsight, 2020, yeah, this makes sense. but it is crazy. You're going to have a whole new legislature. Yeah. You know, 35 of us are leaving. But there's a lot of us who are leaving not for anything else. We're just leaving. And I will say, being here 10 years, it's a lot. It's plenty. It's more than enough. And so I feel comfortable that, you know, I could leave at the end of this year, no matter what happens in this congressional race. And I have a legacy and work that I'm proud of. And I'm ready for the next generation to come in.
Right. And it's kind of like what some of us are wondering is, like, you know, there's 30 some members leaving. What is it? Like, is it just that they're going to different offices? Or, you know, a lot of people are just kind of burned out, right? And just not wanting to come. We had like this kind of sensation all around the country, like this great resignation feeling. Kind of like, I guess, what's going on in the legislature? And kind of why do you think some of these people are kind of leaving early?
we're not different than the rest of America. And so the pandemic made us reassess what we were doing and how we wanted to, you know, spend our future coming out of the pandemic. And we were not going back to what normal was. For most of us, normal was exhausting and we were working ourselves into the ground. So I think it gave us that ability to reassess. 10 years in an office is plenty, actually, here. I think for a lot of us, we are able to say, what's my legacy? And most of us are going to be proud of that legacy.
Right.
And, you know, I think things are changing. There's new people coming in, and that's a good thing. And the way we do business is different now than it was, you know, when I got started. And it might be because the membership has changed. It might be because the administration has changed, or, you know, there's lots of changes happening. And so at some point, it's also like, you don't need to fight that change. You can let the next generation come in and step in and be part of that change.
Right. You know, I guess in like the past 2 years, two, 3 years, we've had a lot of change, you know, COVID and everything. But also, like, you know, you guys are in a new building and everything, and you know, restaurants and stuff are closed. Kind of, what are some of the biggest changes you've noticed, I guess, this year versus, you know, 2018?
I don't know for everyone else, but I will say, you know, before it was like 5:30, 6 o'clock, and it's like I have to go support my colleagues at their events, right, or I have to go meet this person, and I'd be out there between 5:30 to 8:30 doing work still, right? And,
right,
and what we call the rounds up here.
Right.
And so coming back, it's like I'm going to be really selective about doing that. Do I really need to do that? Is that the only way or the best way to support my colleagues and build those relationships? And so we do that for relationships, but are there other ways to build relationships? I think the biggest change is not to people like me who've been here for 10 years and we have established relationships in and out of the building. It's for our new members or our new staff who don't have that relationships, and how do they navigate and how do they get things done? And so with 35 of us leaving, and you feel it already right now, that institutional history and knowledge is going to disappear. And so when I see a colleague struggling who's younger in terms, not in age, when we're not here to tell them, hey, this is what you need to do to get around that, it's going to be different how policy gets made and who is really leading and who's in charge out here. And so, but yeah, I mean, there's places to go. And, you know, we're on the other side of the building. And so I've been waiting to see when more things are going to open on that side of the building out there. And, you know, it's not clear to me how everything has changed. In fairness, I've been busy with the congressional race since, you know, January. So I haven't been paying too much attention to what's changed. I've been paying attention to my package, the Women's Caucus. Right. I have an aggressive, you know, package of bills that I'm moving through. I promised myself not to be an absent legislator or an absent chair of the caucus. And so I haven't had a second to think about how things are changing. I'm just kind of like accepting it and going through those motions.
Just adapting. You know, you said, what did you say, 35... seats for women legislators this year?
We have 35 vacancies that are members that are leaving the legislature. And so that means we have a chance to pick up some of those 35 seats, right? I'm not going to pick them all up, but I do expect that the Women's Caucus will grow. And so you have groups that have been working with us to make sure we had a farm ready and we had people identified. And so while this came sooner, we were able to work with groups like Close the Gap and say, okay, let's hurry up and run. Mm-hmm. And we've all been sprinting, but we had an infrastructure set up so that we've been able to have quality candidates, get them, you know, essential endorsements and start to help them fundraise as well.
So I guess out of the 120 legislative spots, just kind of based on population roughly, there should be probably a little more than 50 or 60 legislators, right?
Well, there's 120 legislators in total. If I just had 50-50, I'd need 60, you know, probably a little bit more than that. There's a few more women than men out there. We're at 38. 39 is the most we've ever had, and these vacancies that we had this year got me down to 38 again. But I am confident that we will be close to at least 50 women in the legislature next cycle. Which,
and then how many did you have when you first came in? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but when I became the chair of the Women's Caucus the first time, there were 23 of us.
Wow.
And so it's been work we've been putting in little by little, picking up a couple seats here, a couple seats there, maintaining at a minimum. But this cycle, while it caught us flat-footed in some respect, we were ready. And so I'm confident we're going to capitalize on that, including my seat. I have a talent pool full of women running it. And so women's going to pick up my seat. That's exciting.
And, you know, I guess that's the interesting thing. The more representation you have, I guess the more kind of issues that come up that maybe wouldn't come up before, kind of you kind of pointed to kind of period issues and things like that. No one was talking about that before. You definitely got that into our consciousness. Kind of, what are some of the other things you guys are working for, looking forward to working for this year and the years to come?
I think, you know, while we are not at parity, the Women's Caucus has always been working on different things. And so as we just heard about the Roe versus Wade and potentially it being overturned with the leak of that draft, there's been a lot of reaction, and it's, you know, a lot of folks on the right side of history here in California with us, and we're going to fight. And, you know, the governor's out there doing his press conferences, and we welcome that. But the reality is that even before that happened, the Women's Caucus was doing the good work on reproductive justice. We, in January, rolled out a package of 13 bills to increase access, to protect privacy, to protect out-of-state providers coming to California for services or patients coming for services. And so we had a whole package. And so we've been proactive. We've been doing the good work even before there was a spotlight on this issue, or the spotlight was this big that we have now. And so our goal is to get that all across the finish line. We're also working with the pro tem on a constitutional amendment as well. And so I think that that's the difference between being a strong ally. And I tell folks the best way to be an ally is to get people like me to have a seat at the table, because there's nothing like me telling my own story. It's community members like mine that are going to be affected if Roe is overturned, because you're low income, you're in a rural community, you're in a state that doesn't welcome you probably already. And so where do you go?
Right.
But if you have income, if you have means, you could travel to California. You can make sure you're getting good access out there. And we have these problems of access now in California, even with our rights being protected. The reality is that low-income communities, vulnerable communities, don't have the same access here in California already. And so that's a priority for us. Growing the caucus is a priority. We're working on things like ensuring that we have enough childcare slots and childcare providers. Everyone wants to go back to work, but we're having a hard time with childcare.
Right.
And it's because this is a predominantly female workforce, and they're underpaid. And so we're working to increase their salaries this year in the budget. We have a big ask on that as well. Yeah. We're asking for a couple $1 billion.
Wow.
And people say, wow, but we have a $68 billion surplus,
exactly.
And we have people that need to get back to work. And so it shouldn't be, wow. It's like, why haven't we done this sooner?
Right. $68 billion, kind of the big budget number everyone's talking about. You know, you've always been great, you know, working with the budget in your district. Kind of what are some of the things in your district you're looking to kind of help out your community with in the budget?
PFAS, forever chemical that doesn't break down, and it goes into your body and it stays in your body. And a little bit might not do anything to you, but you have more and more exposure to it. It can lead to a lot of sicknesses, including cancer. Men are more vulnerable than women, actually, in this case. And so it's expensive. It's a legacy chemical that got left behind sentenced by military bases, metal plating companies, aerospace. In districts like mine, all those things are gone. And so it's the ratepayers who are stuck with that. And we already have some pretty high rates in the area for water. So I'm asking for $550 million in the budget to help clean up PFAS across the state in low-income communities to ensure that we don't increase rates for our most vulnerable community members, but they also have clean water out there. I'm asking for more urban greening dollars. And so I am park poor, I'm tree canopy poor, it's a heat island. And it's not just that it's hotter during these heat waves and we're seeing more and more of them because of climate change, it's that the toxics that aren't in my community get more baked and get more potent and toxics out there as well. And so we need to bring up and create this tree canopy out there to fight climate change, to keep the heat down, and to also absorb some of that pollution out there. And so I have an ask for almost $300 million for that. I have some smaller asks. I have a pool in Bell Gardens that hasn't worked for many years, and they want to open it up again. So I'm asking for some money to fix that up for them. It'd be great to have kids be able to go swim in the local pool versus having to take a bus and play cells or playing, you know. I mean, there's not much out there. And so I have asked like that as well. And so we'll see. I'm also working on how do we divert more of our trash into composting? How do we reduce our trash footprint out there, our waste footprint out there? Right now, cities are burning their trash and we're pretending that that's recycling. And so I want to make sure that we stop pretending and we actually recycle or reduce. And we put money and we help those cities transition. So I'm asking for monies for that.
Right. And kind of we were talking offline earlier about kind of, you know, your district is where all the freeways in LA kind of converge. You might have the most freeway per square mile of any other member in the state. kind of, you know, with the federal infrastructure bill, kind of local budgets, and kind of, you know, your championing of environmental justice issues. Can you, I guess, kind of talk about kind of, you know, how those freeways and the division of those kind of affect your district and kind of things you're looking at to kind of help alleviate a lot of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you come down, even here, but it doesn't compare. I'm always like, wow, rush hour here is so nice. Right. But, you know, you're on a freeway and you're just driving through a community and you kind of see stuff to the side, but that's it. And then you get to your community. And for most individuals, it's not a big deal. Other than, like, I really hate the rush hour commute, and I can't believe a 17-mile stretch took me an hour and a half to do, right? That's, like, the reality in LA. But for the community members that you're zooming by, it means we have more particulate matter exposure. We have more asthma rates. It means we have more trucks on our streets on a regular basis, and our kids can play out there. It means that when we decide we need to widen a freeway, you're displacing hundreds, if not thousands, of low-income communities that are Latino and Black. Immigrant in these communities. It means that as you're making decisions about everything else, you always say these communities are disposable or they're sacrifice zones. It's literally, someone just said, it's natural to displace them. And it's like, well, we are all created equal, but really you're not. Because if you live in these low-income communities, you're always an afterthought or you're the sacrifice zone for everyone else's progress. And so it creates a lot of issues for communities like mine. I already have housing insecurity in this area, and all my life we've been told that the 710 freeway is going to expand. And so what happens is, not just are you're afraid to lose your home, but businesses don't want to invest because they might lose their space. So why invest? So it also just affects generational wealth and that economic development along these communities out there as well. Simple things like, hey, why don't we put trees next to the freeway? It would make sense, right? Logical. Yeah. No, because one day we might widen this freeway. Mm-hmm. And so if you drive, there's never any trees along these freeways in these low-income communities. But if you get to higher income communities, there's trees, because they know they're never going to expand the freeway there. The system's set up to protect them.
Right.
And so our life revolves not about avoiding traffic. It revolves around us being sicker all the time, us being worried about being displaced all the time. And now, to add insult to injury, we know from statistics, from data, from research, that these expansions do not lead to more, does not ease congestion, but it actually invites more traffic.
Yeah.
So it makes no sense. So as we're sending infrastructure, some DC dollars from DC over here, let's put them to work in a way that makes sense. So let's build that public transportation, maybe along the freeway corridors, so that people can get out of their cars and those trucks can move those goods movements in a more efficient way. Because that's what these freeways around my community are about. It's a good movements district. And so it's like, yeah, let's get people to work. Let's get those good jobs going, but let's get people out of their cars. And it's not just about widening the freeway. That really doesn't give me any solutions.
Mm. I guess this supply chain shortage has been really, apparent, in your district, and especially your congressional district, Long Beach Port to the kind of inner parts of LA, and that freeway going north-south.
Yeah.
What are you seeing down there right now? What are some of the issues? Are the ports moving better now? And kind of what are some ideas to kind of alleviate some of these issues?
Yeah. So first of all, the issue is because we're shopping differently.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a system that was not planned for the way we shop now. So we need to adjust. Secondly, we have record numbers of goods coming through that port every month. So it's not that we're moving the same amount of goods we were moving 2 years ago. We have record numbers every month, so there's not much more coming
That's
through.
Great.
We have a port that is pretty much 24/7 now, and
mm-hmm.
so we need to rethink and maybe invest in that port, but it can't just be the immediate conflicts. It has to be the whole goods movement from the port to the rail yard in Commerce, which is what this district's about. So the best way to help those trucks move is to get people out of the cars. Let me start with that. So why are we not doing a light rail along those freeway routes that we're already so used to? Why are we not investing more in maybe the shared carpools at the end of those stops,
mm-hmm.
so that people can do the final mile or where they have to go to get to their workplace or their school place or whatever
right.
that might be that they're doing? We also need to think about things like, right now it's been like, well, let's just put containers anywhere near the port. Well, that near the port means in low-income communities of color that are already overburdened with traffic and trucks, you have community members who literally have trucks coming up and down little streets that were residential now because there's an empty lot someplace there, and so we're going to use that for these
right.
containers. I see that in Bell Gardens all the time. And so these solutions that we have is for everyone else's convenience and not for the community members. And so we need to help, streamline the process, and it's not just about moving them from the port to the rail yard, but the port itself of how things are coming in needs to be rethought. And you need to have a better infrastructure to move things directly from the port to a rail yard there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to me that we're transporting things from Long Beach over to Commerce. How do you do it more there? And we stop that transition. And if you're going to be doing that, even simple things like, why don't we have a direct truck route and lane, you know, just for trucks? Maybe we incentivize clean trucks. Mm-hmm. So we're cleaning this up sooner. And that's what gets the express lane into right. into the rail yard out there. But I think right now we're throwing money. And if we're throwing money into the same system, we've accepted that screwing over low-income communities of color is normal and it's okay. And this is 2022 where we've all read those books about being anti-racist and taking mm-hmm. actions and, you know, getting a little bit uncomfortable and using our privilege to help other people. Well, this is a good place to help other people out there, right? It's like mm-hmm. if we know that these policies are systemically marginalizing communities of color, then we should do something about
right.
it.
Right. Now that's interesting. It's just something you just don't think about, you know, but your district kind of like totally amplifies it all, right? It's the whole country relies on this,
yeah.
basically.
Well, I mean, when the commission was drawing that line, it wasn't drawing a line based on what the people needed or wanted. Mm-hmm. It was literally two districts drawn adjacent to each other, and it was around the port.
Right.
And goods movements are an important part of our economy, and I want that to thrive. But that can't be the only piece of the puzzle, because if you're saying that, you're always saying someone else's bottom line comes over all these people that happen to be Black, Brown, and immigrants. Mm-hmm. It's thousands of people. We're not talking about just five people.
Right.
That district is 730,000 people. Most of them are low-income Latinos. The reality is that I also, in doing the way they drew that line, they drew a district that is predominantly Latino, but the votes are in the affluent white communities to the south. And so, you know, if you continue to perpetuate the system, we've said for the next 10 years, this community continues to be a sacrifice zone.
So is it because you're saying voter turnout in the wealthier areas is higher than
yeah.
the Latino version? Or
yeah.
there's more population in the...
No, there's more population in the Latino district, mm-hmm. but they're younger, they're undocumented, right. or they're immigrant and are not citizens. And you also have a system that hasn't exactly welcomed them to participate if they are citizens. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, voter turnout is lower in that side of town. But there's more people. But
right.
when you have much more concentration of voter turnout in a wealthier white community, I don't care if you've drawn a Latino district, you're gonna have representation that often is gonna pander to that wealthier
right.
side of town. And so we're not pandering to our most vulnerable community. And they talked about equity, and they literally talked about equity this week when I asked a question of that, of them. And it's like, no, if this is your definition of equity, it was around goods movements and protecting the southern part of the district, this mm-hmm. is not equitable.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Something you wouldn't normally think about.
Well, because out of sight, out of mind, right? Or it's not your reality. And this is why you have to have people that's the reality at the table.
Right.
Because the reality is that if you are of means, you're going to move out of that community.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The reality is it's moving on up. We are taught as young folks that success is leaving and never coming back. And so it's not your fault that you're not thinking about
right.
it. But those people who are in those communities don't have a seat at the table ever.
And you know, I guess that's kind of the cool thing about you is that as you've gone successful, you've always stayed. You're still in your same house, your same neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
And you're kind of that community. And so as you know, it is the season with the primary, 30 days away, you're going door to door, you're talking to lots
yeah.
of people in the community. What is on top of their mind right now when you're talking to these people?
It varies. If I'm talking to folks in Long Beach at the coast, it's climate change and sea level rise and subsidence followed by homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And frustration because their tax dollars help fund the system, and we spent billions of dollars, right, but it hasn't gotten any better. So frustration about how their tax dollars don't seem to be producing results. And I think when I talk to them, they're okay with spending money. They just want to make sure it's spent and there's solutions and there's results on the
right.
other end of it. As you travel north to the district, community members are still just trying to survive, literally, because we have another wave of COVID, so they're afraid of that. And then just trying to survive because economically, they've never recovered from the last recession. The pandemic hit them hard, and so they're still just struggling to survive. And inflation is so high
right.
that they feel it. And so simple things like when I go to the grocery store, which is where I get stopped the most often,
mm-hmm.
it's like my milk and my carne asada is so expensive.
Right.
People are like freaking out over the amount of things. And their salaries haven't gone up proportionally
yeah.
out there. And so they're struggling to make ends meet.
So that's funny. So people recognize you and they stop you in the store
yeah.
and tell you that. That happened to me yesterday. This woman stopped me and told me about this loaf of bread that was $8. And she was just like, can you believe this is
$8? Yeah. I mean, there are moments where I stop at the grocery store and I pick up like the five things that I always pick up on a Sunday. And it's like, how am I paying $40 or something? I was paying $20 for it before. It's like, I could afford it, but I know my neighbors can't afford it. That's the difference. I know I have privilege. And that privilege has been because my community members invested in me growing up and never expected anything in return. I'm like, and so I need to take that privilege and help make their life a little bit better on a regular basis, right? I'm going to always gamble on them and bet on them. It was like, people were like, you're an underdog. Are you sure you're going to win this congressional race? And I was like, I'm always going to gamble on my community because someone has to, because no one else is doing it.
Right.
But I've been privileged to experience and get to do all these things. And it's because community members took care of me. Simple things. If I was messing around, someone was calling my dad to leave work to come take care of it. I have a friend whose mom made lunch for me for 4 years in high school because she knew I never had lunch. So if I had lunch, I could think during period 5 and 6. I wasn't just sitting there starving the whole time like some of my colleagues.
Wow. And so, like, you know, your campaign started in January, primary in June.
Mm-hmm.
You said there's 700,000 people in the district. Mm-hmm. Obviously, not all of them registered voters. How many doors are you looking to knock on, you know, before June?
I'm going to knock on as many doors as I can, but I'm not doing it alone. I do have a team of volunteers out there on the ground who are working hard. Southeast LA leaders have all come and unified around this campaign, and so they're also working in conjunction with their volunteers to make sure that we're voting, to make sure that our community members know that they have a champion that's fighting for them, but they need to do their part, and we need them to be our partners, and we need them to vote, and we need their family members to vote. We're talking to voters also as we move south out there. But, you know, when I'm not here, I'm at home knocking on doors on a regular basis. I would say I'm going to knock on as many doors, but it's never enough because there's 400,000 voters and I'm never going to get to them. So it's just about, at the end, I just need to knock on enough doors. I need to get my message out there. People ask me what makes me stand out to all the other Democrats who are running. And you talked about Deidre Garcia and the race before the show started. I'm like, do you want someone that has 10 years of substance and delivering? I'm like, or do you want someone that's the status quo? We're going to get more of the same. And so are we ready for change and for a fighter that's going to be fearless? Or do we want to continue with that comfort of the usual? And I would say the usual isn't working. The usual has a lot of gridlock in D.C. The usual is about to overturn for the first time in my lifetime my right to control my body, especially for our lowest income community members. The usual is definitely not working. Something needs to change.
Right.
And so you have someone that's been delivering and getting it done for 10 years, beating the odds, talking about issues that no one wants to talk about or initially people think is dumb. Like, why are you talking to me about your period?
Right.
All right. Why are you talking to me about freeways? I think every step of the way I've brought up issues that initially people are like, why are we having this discussion? Mm-hmm. But after a little bit of education, like, oh, why weren't we having this discussion sooner?
Right. You know, in your campaign, you've been endorsed by Dolores Huerta, a known fighter, and I guess she recognizes that you kind of, how did that endorsement come about? And what does that mean to you and your campaign?
You know, I've been blessed. I don't have a long history of knowing Dolores. I got to know her through this work a little bit. She got to learn a little bit about more who I am through this work here in the legislature. And so she's been a role model and inspiration for so many of us. And I just picked up, actually in 2018, she picked up the phone and was like, I want to support you.
Really? That's awesome.
And I was like, and she came at a point where I was like, I really need some support just for like the moral support. And so since then we've had a relationship. So I just picked up the phone and I made the ask. And, you know, she said yes right away. And she's always just had one condition for me, that I'm a fighter and that I keep fighting for the community. And so, you know, a lot of us are on her shoulders. She's been fearless, she's been attacked, she's been dismissed, and she's never given up, and she continues to be a leader until today out there. And so it's exciting when I have community members like that behind me. It makes the work that I'm doing worthy, because while there's a lot of perks to this job, it's not all rosy.
Right. No, definitely not.
There's a lot of, especially when you're the underdog out there, right? And so I have lots of other folks that would traditionally be my friends are like, no, we're not going to be your friend this time around. And so you need to rely on those endorsements at the end of the day. I think the other set of endorsements that are really important to me are the close to 90% of the local Latino Southeast LA electeds have endorsed my race as well and actually recruited me to run for this seat. And so they also want to guarantee they have a strong voice at the table. And so that confidence they have that they're going to have a fight or someone that's going to bring stuff to the district is exciting as well.
Yeah. And you know, you are doing legislation this year. You are still making news here in the legislature this year. Can we talk a little bit about the bills you're kind of looking forward to, and especially AB 2932, the four-day work week? Kind of how's that going, and where is that going?
We started with the one bill that didn't get a hearing. but you know what? I think, like I've told folks, we have a soapbox, whether it's here at the city council, county, or at the federal level. And sometimes you're sending out an idea and you're sending out messages to an industry, right? And out there that things need to change. And so while this bill didn't get a hearing, I do think it pushed a discussion further of what does it mean to come back after a pandemic, and what is the work-life balance going to be? How do we have a better quality of life? How do we share that benefit with our employees? And their great resignation, as people are calling it. I'm like, you have 47 million Americans that have quit their job voluntarily looking for better opportunities. And when you ask them what that means, they talk about better mental health, better physical health, more time to do the things they love or to spend with their family. And so it makes sense. We have to rethink this. We have to go back to better, not to how it was. And countries like Japan, Iceland, Spain are doing it, and they're saying that it's working out. Microsoft has a small pilot, and they're seeing a 40% productivity increase out there. And so, you know, businesses can sit around and continue to try to go back to how it was, and they're going to continue to have a labor shortage, which is the bottom line, or they could adapt. And this is one way to adapt and another benefit to share with your employees. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it didn't get a hearing. It's gonna get an informational hearing, so we'll get to continue the discussion that way. But yeah, it's funny that that's the one bill you started with. All my other bills are moving.
Everyone always asks me. All my clients ask me, "What's going on with this 4-day work week?"
Yeah,
I like how we invoke Spain there. Maybe we'll just start with a siesta.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's just this okay, but the 5-day work week was created for the Industrial Revolution. It's been 100 years. We've had so much progress, and technology has made so much of that progress possible. In the same way that we're like, you can't work from home, that's never going to work, right? It's working just fine. Yeah. I'm like, you can also adjust this. And the reality is that, I mean, how many times are you like, oh, I'm going to go watch something else on the video during work hours or whatever? Because we also at some point we get tired, it's exhausting, you know, and so it's like I'm not surprised to see more productivity in companies that are doing this and things are getting done. I'm not surprised that they're not having a labor shortage out there, and so you can fight it all you want, and for companies, you don't need to have a bill, you don't need to call it a job killer. You're killing your own jobs, you're killing your own industry, your own business by not adapting.
Yeah, it's just so fascinating. The world changed, and like, you know, I think work from home is here to stay. And, you know, it's just kind of like, you know, the sooner people realize that and how to maximize that is how their business is going to take off.
Yeah, it has changed. I mean, I think here in the legislature, I hear colleagues who that want to bring their staff in full time. And I was like, why? Like, they're producing at home. Why do you need them here all the time? Why are you going to expose them? We always have these waves now.
Right.
You have childcare issues also. And those same colleagues are losing staff members left and right. And so it's like, you just have to adjust.
Right.
It's not the end of the world. 2 years, we've been able to adjust. You know, you had plenty of time to practice.
So, you know, we talked about the one bill that didn't get a hearing. What bills did get hearings and that are progressing and making their way to the Senate that you're excited about?
I have AB 1778, which would not allow the state to give permits or dollars to expand or widen freeways in low-income communities of color. Mm-hmm. And so it would help stop displacements of communities like mine. I have a bill that would allow professors at the Cal States to take a whole semester off when they are taking maternity leave. Right now you're trying to plan your baby around your summer break, and that doesn't always work out that way. If you have to take a leave in the middle of the semester, oftentimes you have to find your own substitute, and then you have to give them your salary.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And so it's a system that's pretty pretty unfair out there for women and for new families out there. And so that bill is also moving as well. And I think it would be the first step to hopefully be a model to a better system for all mothers here in California. We just celebrated Mother's Day. I think, you know, a lot of developed countries have real time off for mothers, 6 months, a year, so you could bond, and we know how important that is.
Right.
There are developed countries that are thriving. We could afford to do it too.
Yeah.
And so hopefully a model there. And we have a bill. Currently in California, if you we have two incinerators, and we pretend that if you burn your trash, it's recycling. And they're pretty old incinerators, and so we give them credits like they're recycling, and so I have a bill to remove that incentive, that credit, call it what it is, it's still burning trash, so let's call it that. Mm-hmm. And then monies also to help those cities that have those incinerators transition to a better way to manage their waste.
So two in the state or two in your
two
district?
In the state, two okay. in the state. There's technically more than two, but they're for things like burning medicines, for burning guns, and they serve a different purpose. These are the ones that are straight for communities that are supposed to be recycling and composting and reducing waste that are not right. meeting that, and so they'll just burn it. And so it's a problem. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for those neighborhoods. Again, those are incinerators that are in low-income communities of color. Right. And so I have that. I have a bill for Dreamers. We have the Dream loan program here, and so you could get a loan from the state, but it doesn't match the federal programs where we don't have the service forgiveness. So we are trying to build in that we can forgive some of those loans if you are of service in your community and in areas that are needed out there as well. So we're working that bill through the yeah. legislature right now. You caught me off guard. I have like 15 bills. And oh, wait, I'll share two more bills. I have one on diet pills and supplements. So right now, minors could buy diet pills and supplements. And yeah. so I want parents to be aware that they're over-the-counter, and they make your kids sick. A kid is one in four times more likely to end up with an eating disorder in the hospital if they're taking some of these supplements right. out there. And so I just want to make it illegal to sell this stuff to minors. You could mm-hmm. still get it with a prescription. If you're an adult, you could have all you want of it. Right. But our kids should not be having this. They have body image issues out there, and you have people who are profiting off of that during a really vulnerable time right. In their lives. And so that bill's also moving.
Oh, that's interesting. So campaign's coming up. June 7th?
June 7th.
Is the date. Kind of if our listeners want to find out more about your campaign and kind of how they can get involved or find more information, how would they do that?
Yes, ChristinaForCongress.com mm-hmm. is the best place to go, and there's no H in my name for your listeners right. out there. And I'll tell you, the only time I've been witty in it, it didn't work out very well. Right. I was at a dinner with Governor Brown, and he wrote me a note, and he put an H in my name, but mm-hmm. he had done that for about three different dinners, and right. I had told him, I was like, I'm going to charge you for this. You know, the first one's free, and then you owe me $20 million in the budget. And so he comes over, and we're talking, and I was like, you misspelled my name again, and he tells right. me, well, Christ has an H in his name. Mm-hmm. And then I say, Cristo does not. Right. And he looks at me and doesn't know what to say and just turns around and walks away. I was like, oh, the one time I'm witty, and the right. governor just left me. Yeah. But yeah, that's the best way. And this is definitely a people driven campaign. And so if you want someone who's going to be a fighter, who's not afraid to take on whatever, including her own friends sometimes, right. For a righteous cause, you know, we need your help and look us up.
I am so excited to see you on C-SPAN and Fox News, just them complaining about you left and right. Hopefully you can get more, more publicity than AOC out there when you get to DC.
You know what? I like AOC, and it's good to have North Stars like AOC. But then you need people who are actually bringing stuff back to the district, and right. that's who I want to be.
Yeah, good stuff done. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for coming back and joining us, and best of luck to you this next month and getting into the top two.
Yep, thank you.
All right, thanks.